Rough terrain is the biggest obstacle to fighting two new fires in the Bitterroot Valley. Good evening, I'm Corin Cates Carney, and that's our top story on Montana Evening Edition.
If you plan on becoming a school bus driver in Montana, you'll need a criminal background check. I'm Conrad Scheid, and Edward O'Brien discusses television, movies, and rude theater audiences with NPR film critic Kenneth Turan.
Two new wildfires are burning in the southwestern Montana wilderness. Bitterroot Forest Public Affairs Officer Todd McKay says a team of 19 hotshots and one bucket helicopter are assigned to the Goat Lake Fire, which is burning in the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness 5 miles west of Darby. Meanwhile, a team of repellers are attempting to clear enough space near the Railroad Creek Fire to land crews in a helicopter. McKay says the terrain has made fighting both fires difficult.
You know, anytime you're back in that steep, rugged country, especially the Goat Lake Fire, there's a lot of down and dead timber in there that makes footing and just moving around in there and trying to build fire line very difficult.
Both fires are under 5 acres and neither are threatening any structures. So McKay says crew safety is the number one priority at the moment. Most of the smoke in the sky of western Montana is coming from fires in Oregon, Idaho, Washington, and Canada.
Kenneth Turan says people frequently remind him just how lucky he is to have such a great job, and the National Public Radio and Los Angeles Times film critic is quick to agree. Turan says his dad had a tough job, so he knows a good job from a bad one. However, he adds he's constantly subjected to dreadful films. Unlike members of the general public who can pick and choose the movies we want to see, Turan's required to watch all, or at least most of them. That's why he says the process of writing his latest book, Not to Be Missed, 54 Favorites from a Lifetime of Film, was such a joy to write. All he had to do was focus on movies that made him happy. Turan was recently in Montana on a family vacation and kindly agreed to visit Montana Public Radio to speak with Edward O'Brien. Turan explains why he decided to write specifically about 54 great films.
I wanted a manageable number. I didn't want to do 1,000 films. I wanted to do a number that people could potentially see. If someone wanted to see them all, it wouldn't kill them to see them all. And then I thought, well, I'll do something in the 50s, alliterated with film, alliterated with favorite. I thought 52, 55, 57. I said, well, why not 54? And then I thought nothing more of it. I thought it was a random choice. Mm-hmm. A friend of mine, I said, how many films? And I said 54. And he said 3 times chai. Chai is a Hebrew word. It has 2 definitions. It means the number 18 and it means life. So in the Jewish tradition, any multiple of 18 is a lucky number. 18, 36, 54, 72. Those are all lucky numbers. And since I was raised in a traditional Jewish home, I knew this, and it just subconsciously it came out. I thought I picked 54 for no reason, but I picked it because it was 3 times chai.
In this book, you have a marvelous quote from Roger Ebert, who was one of, I think, the masters. His writing was so wonderful. And that is, every great film should seem new every time you see it. Boy, what a tall order, huh?
Yeah, there's not a lot of films that can do that. And again, you know, this is all personal. This is the films that I feel that way about. I saw all 54 of these films again before I wrote about them, just specifically to write about them. And I was as excited by them as the first time I saw them. You know, it's a wonderful feeling.
One of my favorites out of all of these, and that's, you know, how do you say that out of 54, but The Lady Eve.
Oh, yeah.
With Barbara Stanwyck, Henry Fonda, and Stanwyck never sexier than in this movie.
She's amazing. There's a scene early in the film in the stateroom on an ocean liner between her and Henry Fonda, and the byplay between them, it's jaw-dropping. Yeah. And the more I see it, the more I'm aware of how seamless it is, of how impeccably it's constructed, directed, acted. It's just a perfect piece of cinema.
And how they got some of the stuff through the censors of the time. You look at it, and it's not blatant at all like it would be today.
No. I mean, that's what you know, because of the censorship, they had to find ways around it. They had to be clever. They had to be witty. And the dialogue just sparkles.
Yeah, Preston Sturges.
Yes, one of the greats.
Name a couple of others that you, out of these 54, would really stick with you.
Well, Children of Paradise, a French film, is probably my favorite film. It's an epic romance. It's almost 3 hours long. It's about a woman and 4 very different men who fall madly in love with her. It's set in Paris in the early 1800s. It's just an epic and a romance. It's everything you want in a film. And, you know, there's another French film that I always think of called The Earrings of Madame De. And it's by a man named Max Ophuls, who was a director known for his moving camera work. And it's again, it's a romance. A lot of my favorite films are romances, ill-fated romance. And there's scenes of where the two characters, Daniel Dario plays the woman, Vittorio De Sica plays the man. And it's a series of balls where they meet, and you see them dancing, and each dance kind of melds seamlessly into the last dance, and it's like a series of like a dozen dances, and the camera's twirling, and they're twirling, and it's just dazzling.
Do they, as they say, make them like that anymore?
No, they don't really. Sometimes they do, especially the people who don't make them like that anymore is Hollywood, really, more than anyone, because the dynamics of the studio system have changed. They have to make a profit. They have to appeal to overseas audiences as well. So this means kind of comic book movies, game movies, toy movies.
They're aiming towards 14-year-old boys.
They really are, because they can count on them. You know, they have nothing against aiming towards adults, but, you know, we're fussy. We don't want to necessarily go out unless we have a guarantee that something's going to be good. And younger people, they see a name, they see Jackass, they say they get online. They don't wonder, is this a good Jackass movie? Should I wait for the next Jackass movie? They're there.
You know, I could make an argument, I think, that TV, Mad Men, Breaking Bad, The Sopranos, The Walking Dead, are better than a lot of what's in the movie theater. If you would agree with that, what's happening to make that happen?
No, in Los Angeles, where both, you know, the movies and TV are headquartered, you hear that a lot. TV has taken over the movies. This is what's interesting now, and the movies are kind of yesterday. You know, obviously, TV's in a great moment now, and one advantage they have is the long form. They can play a storyline out over 12 hours in 40 hours. And, you know, The Wire is a TV series I love, and it plays out over 5 seasons, its storyline. So movies can't compete with that. But part of the reason TV is more interesting now is that TV has not given up on adults. Their economics are different, especially the pay cable channels, whose mandate is to do something different, whose mandate is to do something that people can't find elsewhere. That's why people subscribe to HBO and Cinemax and Showtime. They want to see something different. So while movies have abdicated their adult responsibilities, TV has stepped into the breach. And I think movies could be as interesting as TV, but they choose not to be.
And yet I think the cable pay model, that's going to be changing here a lot. I'm a cord cutter. I get my stuff from Apple TV. And
yeah, I don't know how that's going to play out. I mean, we're really living in a transition era. I mean, that's a very good point. I don't know what's going to happen to those people when that happens. What's going to happen to HBO when people cut the cord? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a very good question. We're going to find out. But it's not at all clear how that's going to pay out.
Yeah. And you know what? I really don't like going to the movies, and it's because people are so inconsiderate. I don't want to hear their candy bar crack. I don't want to hear the exposition or their review as it's going along.
I know. You wish people had better manners. I mean, it seems like an old-fashioned thing to say, but I think that's just the reality. In Los Angeles and around the country, there are now theater chains that specialize in a, like, elite experience, you know, where they charge more money and they police the theaters and the seats are better and there's no gunk on the floor and, you know, they stop people from talking. And, you know, those are hugely popular, but they're a small segment of the theatrical thing. It's sad what's happening to the theater-going experience. People are not enjoying it the way they used to. You know, I think back, every once in a while, you go to an old theater from the 20s, you know, one of these great movie palaces. And in those days, it was mass and class. It was an elite experience for a lot of people. And I wish we could get back to that.
It was like flying.
Yeah.
And 3D. They tried to suck us back in, and they did that for a little while for a premium price in some theaters. What do you think?
Well, what happened with 3D is they killed the goose that laid the golden egg. 3D used well is still amazing. What started the current 3D boom was Avatar. And Avatar in 3D on a big screen was a phenomenal experience. Gravity in 3D was a phenomenal experience. But the problem is they want to put the words 3D up in an ad and charge more money. They don't care if 3D is well used. And if you misuse it or if you don't have a film that really needs it, people say, why did I spend this extra money? But in its place, 3D can do amazing things.
I would like to ask a question that may seem disrespectful, but it's not at all meant to be. In this age of Rotten Tomatoes and Facebook and Twitter, are professional movie critics relevant anymore?
I think so. I really don't feel that it's changed. I think people always want something that's well written. They want something that feels authoritative. They want to hear from someone who's seen a lot of films and who's done this. People want to hear an individual voice. I think you want more than just the number either Rotten Tomatoes gives you or that, you know, Metacritic gives you. You finally want to hear what a person says, what a person thinks. a person who's, you know, whose taste you follow, then you know how you correlate with that. I don't feel that that's going away. I really don't.
And you have a distinctive voice, literally and figuratively. How did you get hooked into National Public Radio? I'm assuming from the LA Times? Or?
Yeah, it was just happenstance. You know, I mean, I was at one point in time, you know, the LA Times sends me to Cannes. And Morning Edition was looking for someone to kind of be on the telephone with them to report on Cannes. And there weren't that many American journalists who were there. So they asked me if I wanted to, you know, talk to whoever the host was about Cannes. I said, sure. I did that, you know, for 2 or 3 years. And then they decided they wanted to make a change, hire a new critic on Morning Edition. And they thought of me because I'd worked with them at Cannes. And that's how it started.
Wow. Is it fun?
Oh, it's wonderful. Mm-hmm. I just love the radio. I don't know. I mean, I'm more interested in radio than television.
What's Cannes like? Is it a farce? Is it a spectacle? Is it a whole lot of fun?
It's all those things, you know. I mean, there's a great quote from Cannes that I've used before where someone who's been there a lot says, not only is Cannes impossible to describe to people who haven't been there, it's impossible to describe to people who have been there.
Best 2 or 3 films of this year so far.
You know, one of the films I think of is a film I saw at Cannes, which counts, and it'll come out in October. It's a film called Foxcatcher. Directed by a man named Bennett Miller, who did Capote, who did Moneyball. He's a good young director. This is based on a true story of a member of the DuPont family, John DuPont, who was very wealthy, very eccentric, who in the early 1980s decided he was going to support the U.S. wrestling team, the Olympic wrestling team. And he did do that for a number of years, and a couple of gold medal winning wrestlers trained with him at his place in Pennsylvania that he called Foxcatcher. That's the name of the farm that he trained on. And he went crazy, and he murdered one of these wrestlers. It's an astonishing story. It's got a great cast. Steve Carell, a non-comedic role, looking completely different. You would not recognize him except for his voice. He plays the wealthy DuPont, and the two wrestling brothers are played by Mark Ruffalo and Channing Tatum.
Been speaking with Kenneth Taranla of the Los Angeles Times and National Public Radio, author of the new book, Not to Be Missed, 54 Favorites from a Lifetime of Film. It's a wonderful read-through. It's published by Public Affairs. Pleasure to meet you.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure to be here.
The Montana State Board of Public Education is requiring every school bus driver in the state to undergo a criminal background check. The board approved the rule Thursday after a legislative audit committee found that 64 of the state's nearly 1,500 drivers working in the 2011 to 2012 school year had a criminal history. Two of those drivers had drunken driving convictions within the past 3 years. The committee then recommended that the public office instruction and require criminal background checks for all school bus drivers in Montana. Office of Public Instruction Chief of Staff Madeline Quinlan says the checks will be integrated into existing hiring standards.
School bus driver currently and will continue to be required to have a commercial driver's license. So there are a number of pieces that a bus driver has to go through to get that. The standards look at their ability to drive a school bus. They need to have a minimum of 5 years of driving experience. They also have to go through a physical examination and have a safe driving record. So it's certainly been the requirement of various school districts that the applicants that they have within their own district, that they've required that bus drivers go through a background check, but we haven't had a statewide requirement.
Quinlan says each school district will have to incorporate the background checks into their local hiring practices, either by paying for the checks or requiring applicants to pay it for themselves. She also says an applicant's criminal history doesn't necessarily mean they're disqualified from driving a school bus.
The conclusion that the school district needs to come to is that they may have a criminal offense, but what they're looking for is a criminal offense that would be dangerous to children. I mean, there could be some things that maybe were related to handling of money or something like that, that was a criminal offense, but that might not prohibit them from becoming a bus driver.
Drivers must have no more than one moving traffic violation in the past year and no drunken driving convictions in the past 3 years.
In tonight's forecast, across the listening area this evening, it should remain partly cloudy, with a chance of isolated showers and thunderstorms in central Montana and lows in the mid-40s to upper 50s. Saturday will bring more clouds and highs from 75 to 90. There's a high wind advisory in effect for the Rocky Mountain Front from early Saturday morning until midnight. Sunday will be mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms, highs in the 80s. And now for the editorial comments of Terry Kendrick.
While the conservatives on the U.S. Supreme Court have astounding empathy for the feelings of corporations and the undue burden that laws place on them, in the court's rulings, women have no such luck. In the Hobby Lobby case, the Supreme Court ruled that closely held corporations can refuse to cover contraceptives in their employee health plans according to the religious beliefs of the employer, even when those beliefs are not scientifically accurate. Quote, "It is not for us to say that their religious beliefs are mistaken or insubstantial," wrote Justice Alito for the majority. Really? I thought it was exactly for the court to say. The ruling covers all prescription contraceptives, not only IUDs or morning after pills. The majority ruling assures us that this doesn't apply to other religious beliefs. So if a business is owned by Christian Scientists and they don't want to cover health insurance for their employees because it goes against their beliefs to seek any medical treatment, this ruling doesn't apply. Why not? Why is one set of religious beliefs so much more important than another? The court's ruling indicates that only one set of religious values matter, Christian fundamentalism. What if I'm a business owner and my religious belief is that male children should not be circumcised? Why couldn't I say that I don't want to have that procedure covered in the health plan I offer my employees? If I feel that some cancer treatments are a result of stem cell research and that I'm convinced, regardless of what scientists say, that stem cells come from aborted fetuses, why couldn't I exempt cancer treatment from my employees' health plan? From the current court's point of view, there are good reasons why my scenarios couldn't happen. Circumcisions happen to male children, and both women and men get cancer. Only women get pregnant. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg suspects that this ruling is more about women and less about religious freedom. She wrote a scathing dissent. She points out that the undue burden is now on the woman, and that the cost of an IUD is almost as much as a month's salary for full-time workers at minimum wage. She stated that religious corporations are not significantly burdened by including contraceptive coverage in their health insurance plans. The Affordable Care Act doesn't require businesses to purchase or directly provide contraceptives to their employees. It requires them to put money in a health plan that covers a variety of services. Even if the corporation was burdened by the requirement, Ginsburg argued, the government has shown that providing no-cost or low-cost birth control to women is, quote, a compelling interest in public health and women's well-being, end quote. The ability to control whether or when to have children affects women's financial and job security and women's sense of self-determination. Ginsburg addressed the issue that seems obvious to everyone except the five men in the majority. The female employees who share the same religious beliefs as those of the owners of Hobby Lobby are not mandated to use contraceptives. They don't have to talk about them with their doctor. They're not forced to get a prescription or do anything. They have that right. That is the core of freedom of religion and the separation of church and state. I grew up learning that in this country, we do not get to impose our religious beliefs on other people or have their beliefs imposed on us. Maybe that's never been true throughout our history, but it certainly isn't true now. In this ruling, the court turned its back on previous legal precedent in cases similar to this one. I listened to Rachel Maddow talk about a case in 1968 in which the Supreme Court ruled that a restaurant owner could not deny services to black people, even though the owner felt that segregation was justified in the Bible and that integration went against his religious beliefs. The owner was emphatic. He strongly believed that segregation was central to Christianity. The court basically said, too bad. You don't get to discriminate against people based on your personal beliefs. Just because you strongly believe an action is justified doesn't make it so. Justice Ginsburg wrote of the current case, "For one thing, we are, going forward, no longer allowed to argue the science. Also, going forward, we are not allowed to argue the depth of religious conviction. Once those are off the table in this case, they are either off the table forever or the court will decide in the future what's off and what's on," end quote. Several of the decisions handed down recently call into question the very legitimacy of the court. Why bother to take a case all the way to the Supreme Court unless you are politically aligned with Alito, Kennedy, Roberts, Scalia, and Thomas? If I were a political conservative, I'd try to get everything I could before this court. Take the ball and run with it. This may be your opportunity to legalize witch hunts. This is Terry Kendrick. Thanks for listening.
Terry Kendrick is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Corin Cates-Carney.
And I'm Conrad Scheid. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week.